This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
As our understanding of the minds of children with autism continues to grow, new methods are being used to both evaluate and nurture those children.
We have been able to discover some very characteristic signatures in the way that children move that will classify them as autistic.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about research published last summer from scientists at Indiana University about new ways to interact with these young people. We'll also go to a science fair, and not one of those Mentos and Diet Coke volcano science fairs. This one has actual science. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute finding out how mosquitoes smell. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A new approach for evaluating and assessing autism in children was published last year by researchers at Indiana University. Shane Lauder has an in-depth look at this fresh new way of looking at these young people.
One out of every 50 children in America is diagnosed with some degree of autism, but each child's symptoms and development are unique. What is considered autism varies, and children can be misdiagnosed. While several therapeutic systems have been developed to identify degrees of autism and steer autistic children towards workable social skills, communication, and even entry into mainstream schools, success has not always been consistent or even predictable. On July 24th, a team of physiology and psychology researchers from Indiana University and Rutgers University published a paper on their new methodology for autism assessment. New because it concentrates on information encoded in the body and its movements, rather than on cognitive testing. The team uses video cameras, touch screens, and motion sensors to track and analyze a child's movements in real time. The researchers say that an individual's constantly fluctuating movements provide far more information about developmental learning than a clinician can track while making notes according to a predetermined system. Dr. Jorge Jose is a professor of physiology and the vice president for research at IU. He described how the neutral quantitative analysis of movement development sets this research apart from research into children's cognitive development.
People have concentrated on trying to understand the cognitive properties of autistic children. What they have not looked at is how do they move when they are young. And it turns out that movement is a very important characteristic of humans. In fact, humans are the only animals, when they are born, don't know how to move. It takes about 4 years, 3, 4 to 5 years, for children to learn how to move like adults. So in fact, there is a significant amount of information one can measure in a quantitative way by looking at the movement of anybody really, but in particular children. And what we have actually been able to do, we have been able to discover some very characteristic signatures in the way that children move that will classify them as autistic.
In the research study, volunteer subjects were fitted with motion sensor devices and allowed to move around a room where computer screens played videos. The children's natural movements towards or away from videos were recorded, as was the quality of their movements, random and disjointed or noisy, or calm and focused. Dr. Jose's partner in this research project is Dr. Elizabeth Torres, assistant professor of psychology at Rutgers. The two scientists have worked together on research projects for several years, keeping in touch while at different universities. Dr. Torres' research into the particulars of movement started with robotics, as she determined the complex decisions and neural functions that go into simple motions like pointing. Torres says she was drawn to apply movement analysis to autism research because of what she sees lacking in current assessment techniques.
The main problem with autism is that it's never been actually properly measured. It's been diagnosed based on observation of the behavior, on verbal reports and opinions, and the scoring system is what we call in science subjective. It lacks the rigor that a scientific, truly scientific method to research would need. And because of that, it's very controversial and it generates a lot of uncertainty in the scientific community and in the therapists and so on. So, for example, the current behavioral therapies that have been in place for many, many, many years have not been successful in really turning the individual into an independent, you know, autonomous human being. And if you have a success story, they can't reconstruct exactly what happened, you know, trajectory of that person from when it started to when it finished to reproduce that in another person, you know. And so because it's all based on observation and they take notes and they score based on a system they've created and so on, but it misses a lot of critical information throughout that development. So what this new methodology enables you to do, and it's not a methodology that says, for example, applied behavioral therapies are bad, or DIR float time therapies are bad, or facilitated communication-based therapies are bad. It doesn't. Our methodology is neutral to any of that. What our methodology enables you to do is, for example, compare in a given child on an individual basis whether applied behavioral therapy would be more effective to that child than DIR floor time therapy, than independent typing therapy, or any, you know, music therapy. It just tells you right away whether things are working well for that child or not. And the behavior, the movements tell you that. The movement patterns. Hidden in the movement patterns are many, many pieces of information that escape the conscious eye of the clinician, because we don't process all the information consciously. There's a huge amount of information that goes largely beneath our awareness, and instrumentation captures that, and our methodology captures that, and then tells you not only what the child is doing with a purpose, but it tells you what the child's doing spontaneously, and those spontaneous movements are the ones that are really revealing the progression of the child.
Torres and Jose both emphasize that their micro-movement analysis methodology does not negate or replace current treatments and intervention therapies for autistic children, but rather supplies a neutral means to assess how effective a given therapy is for someone who can't communicate in words. That inability to communicate in words makes micro-movement analysis a potential tool to assess the development of more typical children as well.
It really tells you, like, the capabilities, the hidden capabilities of that child and the predispositions of that child. It reveals what that is. And it's not just for the children with autism. It's for any child. It will tell you, you know, this is really good for your child, or this is not so good.
Torres sought out Jose as a clinical research partner to expand the work she had begun at Rutgers Sensory Motor Integration Lab, because Indiana University has been the site of a long-term study of the genetics of autism. And that study had already established a network of 78 families open to participating in autism research. Children who have not been diagnosed as autistic were included in the study to establish background data as they moved around the study room and interacted with the videos. Special motion capture devices were shipped to Bloomington from Rutgers and set up to record a map of the subject moving through space. The intensely high resolution at 240 frames per second determined the exact degree to which the autistic subject's motions differ from those of more typical children. Dr. Jose said that the results of the study, published last month, have already generated intense interest among scientists studying autism and among parents of autistic children.
Our paper has had a tremendous impact in the last 10 days. The number of people that have read and have downloaded our paper puts it in the top 1% of the 1.4 million papers that have been published this year in the amount of interest it has attracted. So in a sense, a number of people are aware now about the results that we found. And we have been receiving a number of emails from parents that actually tell us that the children have the same type of characteristics in the way they move that we have identified and correlated with the amount of autism that children have.
Dr. Torres is well aware of the potential for this methodology to apply to people's needs beyond the autism community. Her quantitative micro-movement research leading up to this study was with some very able-bodied subjects.
We didn't start this research on autism. I was doing this research on athletes and evaluating what kind of training context and what kind of, you know, of training routines were more appropriate for learning boxing, martial arts, and tennis, the tennis serve, you know. This was how I started with this, you know, evaluating what kind of strategies for teaching person a novice person, you know, what kind of strategies work better, you know, and it tells you in real time, you know, like we trained a lacrosse player to do these boxing routines. We could see what was better for her because, you know, based on the background she brought, what accelerated her learning of the routines, the better timing, the better, faster movements, and so on and so forth.
Dr. Torres hopes that the neutrality of micro-movement analysis and its focus on the individual child's preferences and abilities can counteract a tendency she sees for intervention therapies to fall into commercial competition with each other at the child's expense. Torres feels the practical application of a neutral assessment methodology can have a wide impact in many different environments and on accessible platforms if an investor wants to get involved.
You know, if somebody wants to turn it into these broadly available technology to apply in the classrooms or in the therapeutic intervention places, they could do that. They could do that and then have a precise measurement on a daily basis, chart out the progress of the child. And mom and dad at home can do that, download this information from something as simple as a smartphone.
The next phase for testing this research and methodology, according to Dr. Torres, is an even larger clinical study involving thousands of volunteers with other conditions besides autism, such as ADD and schizophrenia. She has been contacted by hospitals in New Jersey about such a study, which could unite the resources of the New Jersey Department of Education, universities, and local governments. Torres is actively pursuing grant money for the study, as she sees the population and incidence of autistic children growing and encountering new problems as they hit puberty. Considering that growing population, the vast diversity of autistic symptoms, and the increasing integration of people on the autism spectrum into effective mainstream life, and considering that homosexuality was once called a disorder and a disease or condition that might or might not have a cure, I asked Dr. Torres if she could foresee a time when autism is simply one more shade of diversity on the human spectrum.
Very much so. I mean, autism, it could be thought of as a response of the biological system, as a reaction to something that is happening at a much too fast rate for our biology to process. And this could be due to a number of external factors that we don't understand. And you know, evolution didn't prepare us for this. So it's happening. We're just seeing evolution taking place in front of our eyes.
Dr. Torres suggested that the key to approaching autism is acceptance, and that the autistic experience and interpretation of life is far different from what has been called ordinary up to now.
More than the research that we're doing to try and understand it or try and change it and so on, it's to have acceptance of that population, to begin to assume competence of that population because they can do a lot. And just in talking necessarily the language, the autistic person is part of the continuum, of the human continuum. So it's just part of who we are, just like homosexuality is or any other. It's not a disease. It's a condition. In the case of autism, we don't understand it. It may be a reaction to something that is, so we don't understand it at this point. We have very, very little understanding of all of that. But regardless of what that is, of the causes, I think acceptance is first and foremost, you know, the solution to this whole thing, because it's going to be a large number of people affected. It's just this impossibility of processing sensory information, both external and from within the body, and so we can't communicate because their version of the physical world and of themselves is very different from the version of the physical world and of themselves that we have. So we are missing each other.
The paper released by Drs. Jose and Torres is titled Autism, the Micro-Movement Perspective, published in Frontiers in Integrative Neuroscience. An abstract is found online at frontiers, www.autismin.org. I'm Shane Lauder.
Still to come, a new approach is also being taken to the school science fair by introducing actual science. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1218. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When you think about school science fair projects, you might think of baking soda volcanoes or styrofoam models of the planets. More to the point, that's what a lot of students think of and what they enter in science fairs. But to a lot of real scientists, projects like that are missed opportunities. They say that rather than just building models, children as young as 8 or 10 can do actual science and discover new things. Adam Hochberg reports.
When 14-year-old Kyle Gazzillo was getting ready for this year's school science fair in Dalton, Massachusetts, he had a pretty good idea what he wanted to enter.
I was hoping to combine inside a bottle baking soda and vinegar and seeing which ones explode the best.
Of course, it's easy to understand why teenagers gravitate toward projects that explode. Those baking soda rockets and baking soda volcanoes are old standards at science fairs. So popular that you'll find more than 100 videos on YouTube of kids making them. But the more Kyle thought about building effervescent bottle bombs, the less excited he became.
That's something a lot of people know how to do. It's just messy and looks cool. It has no science behind it besides the reaction with baking soda and vinegar or whatever you want to mix.
So by the time we met them at the Massachusetts State Science and Engineering Fair, Kyle and his research partner, Owen Alabozic, were showing off a very different experiment.
We did our project on standing and sitting and how it affects your memory.
Yeah, because when I study, I tend to like to stand, and maybe I was wondering if that affected people. And it did. Standing improved most people's memory.
That new project, one the eighth graders thought of themselves, earned third place in the state finals. And it's the kind of thing the fair's executive director, Cora Beth Abel, wants to see more of. Original research that relates to students' own lives, rather than demonstrations they copy from the internet or from books.
When students own their research, they care about it, and especially when it relates to the world around them. That student really gets excited and inspired in a way that reading a textbook just can't do.
The Massachusetts Fair has promoted that so-called inquiry-based science for years. But when it comes to the smaller fairs that local schools might hold, projects still often lean toward the familiar standbys.
When my daughter had a science fair, what she came home with was the idea to demonstrate something we already know.
That's North Carolina State University biologist Rob Dunn. He helps write a blog about bugs and microbes called Your Wildlife. Lately, he's been on a crusade to improve science fairs that started when his second-grade daughter showed him a list of suggested projects.
The standard sheet of paper had volcanoes. It had lots and lots of beans. You could do a collection of leaves. But what nobody was telling these kids is that even as second graders, they can do science that produces results to questions we don't know the answer to.
Dunn says most kids don't realize there are a lot of questions like that. So on their blog, Dunn and his colleague Holly Menninger asked readers to suggest projects that allow young people to do real science. They got more than 100 ideas.
So what do ants do when it rains? What do spiders in our house eat? What effect does the please pick up after your dog sign actually have on the removal of dog poop from a community?
Those projects focus on things kids see every day and could even yield some new information. But Menninger concedes they also involve something of a leap of faith, because unlike exploding bottles, original projects can have unpredictable results or no useful results at all.
this happens to scientists all the time too, that your hypothesis could have been wrong. And I think that's great. I think that sometimes some of the most exciting discoveries are the things that we don't anticipate.
But who wins a grand prize in a science fair with an experiment that doesn't come up with a result? We want something that goes boom or makes a lot of mold. Those are the ones that win the prizes.
I mean, that's a culture change, I think, sort of steering people away from the final product and focusing more on the process.
Menninger says a lot of kids are ready to do that. The bigger challenge is getting buy-in from adults.
I just have probably the shortest slideshow in the world, I hope.
At Western Carolina University, biology professor Kevin Catley manages a regional science fair and leads these workshops to prepare teachers for it. He says some adults make the fairs worse, parents who do the work for their children, or teachers who provide little guidance.
There's no question in my mind that 80% of the teachers that routinely do a science fair are not competent themselves, and this is no criticism, this is a critique of their educational experience because they've had no research background. So they find it very difficult to advise students, and the quality is pretty bad.
Catley says there's no quick fix for what he calls cookie-cutter science fairs. He says it will take better training for teachers and more support for science in general. But at fairs that have changed their culture, you can see the difference.
And next we have from Taunton High School, Olivia.
As the prizes were handed out at the Massachusetts Fair, the winners ranged from complex projects that studied topics like gene mutation to simple things like a student who found a way to make fluffier cupcakes. What the winners had in common is that they were fresh, scientifically sound, and potentially useful. And there wasn't a baking soda rocket among the bunch. I'm Adam Hochberg.
This production is part of the STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. So here's a question that probably hasn't kept many of you up late at night. How do mosquitoes smell? I'm not talking about what they smell like. How do they detect odors? Now that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Mosquitoes can carry dangerous diseases, but chemical repellents have dangers too. Ananda Sankar Ray, associate professor of entomology at the University of California, Riverside, reveals why a better understanding of how pests find us could lead to a more pleasant outdoor experience.
The tiny female mosquito is one of the deadliest creatures on this planet. Nearly half the world's population is at risk from diseases they transmit, and nearly a million people die every year from malaria, dengue, and filariasis. The female mosquito feeds on blood for nutrients to produce eggs. When it bites an infected person, the disease can be transmitted to others it feeds on later in life. A hungry mosquito smells us using sensitive sensors on the surface of the antenna and the maxillary palps. From a distance, it first detects carbon dioxide plumes from our exhaled breath and uses them to navigate towards us. As the mosquito comes closer, it starts smelling odors from our exposed skin and is attracted even more. The carbon dioxide molecules are known to activate special receptor proteins in neurons of the maxillary palps. However, receptors that cause attraction to skin odor remained elusive till now. A recent study in my lab has identified skin odor-sensing neurons in the mosquito. And to our surprise, the same receptor that detects carbon dioxide also detects odors from our skin. This dual detector of skin and carbon dioxide presents a key target to alter mosquito behavior. Using a computational method, we predicted hundreds of odors that could artificially inhibit or activate this receptor. From them, we identified several that were natural, pleasant-smelling, and affordable. An inhibitory odorant that smells fruity could block detection of skin odors and mask a human arm from mosquitoes. Conversely, an activating odorant that smells minty could lure mosquitoes into a trap. Odors like these present a new generation of affordable strategies to reduce diseases transmitted by mosquitoes.
That was Ananda Sankar Ray of the University of California, Riverside. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.